Hey everybody, it's Writers in the Round. Our guests this evening, we have a poet, Rachel Landrum Crumble. And I put the emphasis on poet because it's been 2 or 3 weeks, I think, since we've had a poet. And Madhya is here, my friend Madhya Swycourt. And Madhya is here because Madhya is, among her many talents, a philosopher. Madhya is the kind of person that you just throw an idea out and it's like, wow, what happened to that last hour? Well, we were talking about that. It was an interesting idea that you just said there.
Okay.
Yes, thank you.
Isn't that true of you?
Yes, I feel that way.
And Madhya also, that's why I hesitate to say, you know, Madhya teaches yoga. Because, well, first, because I'm not sure that you teach it anyway. You model it, right? Mm-hmm. If you are somebody who, quote, teaches yoga, what you're really doing is modeling a way of thinking for people.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You know, the embodiment, at least that's the attempt to, you know, match what I'm saying to how I am or who I am. Mm. You know, integration, but not perfection.
Thank you for adding that.
Please, not right? The burden of perfection.
I know,
or the
right?
I consider that actually boring to be perfect. But,
Yeah, the side of things. Yeah, mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. As I say, Rachel is a poet. She's also a teacher who has, amazingly to me, taught from kindergarten through college level, which, when you stop to think about that, you know, at each level, it's almost like starting over, isn't it?
I guess that's where we get back to that process orientation that I mentioned before we came on air, that I'm very process oriented, and so I can be in the moment with whatever group of learners, I guess. Yeah.
Well, that sounds good, but dealing with children of kindergarten age and dealing with college students, some would say it's exactly the same, but truth is, it isn't, is it?
Right.
Because, somebody in kindergarten, even though they may behave exactly the same way as people in college, they don't think the same way.
Yeah.
Which do you find more challenging, to teach at college level or to teach at that very young elementary level?
Actually, right now I've been teaching for most of the past 20 years in high school. And that is probably the most challenging because it's talking about the whole person. Oh my gosh, there's so many precious, damaged whole persons that don't feel whole and don't know they can be whole that I deal with every day, that a lot of the teaching is sort of modeling dignifying behaviors for them and speaking into their lives that, hey, you're valuable. I see you, you know. As well as content. So, and I'm kind of an individualizer, so I teach students, not content, in, you know, according to the student who they are. Yeah.
Well, that's the most wonderful gift you can give somebody is to say, I see you.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, we all need that, don't we? Yeah.
Especially at that age.
Yeah.
Teenagers.
Yeah. So that's really challenging because it was one of those things where I said when I graduated from colleges, I'm never teaching high school with my English degree. And so I taught adjunct in college, and I taught here too for quite a while, and different places in this area, Covenant and Chattanooga State and here, and taught 2 years full-time at Cleveland State and 1 year visiting professor at Lee a while back.
As far as your writing, you have been married to my friend Jim, Jim Crumble, who is, as I've said many times, I just love to listen to him play.
Yeah.
He always seems to be such an intuitive player.
Mm-hmm.
No matter who I've watched him play with, and I watched him play in a lot of different situations.
Yeah.
It always feels as if while he's at the center, he never seems to view it that way.
Yeah, that's I agree with that insight. Yeah, I appreciate him for those reasons too. Yeah.
You have 3 children?
Yes.
2 of whom are old enough to live on their own.
Yeah, now 3. The caboose left late in life.
Your other son is
21.
Oh, your other son's not a teenager anymore.
No, he's not. I do have poems in which he's a teenager a little bit ago, but yeah, he's He's 21 and living with his 30-year-old brother in Brooklyn, New York now. My 30-year-old is a stylist. So he picks out men's wardrobes for photo shoots and videos. Mm-hmm. And he was just at the Grammys with Roddy Ricch. So,
wow.
Yeah. So he's doing
some responsible
fun stuff.
For the way these people look. Huh?
Yeah, yeah.
I hesitate to make any kind of generalizations about your work based on what is effectively a grab bag of your poems that I found in different publications online.
Right, because they're not all online, but yeah, go ahead.
But the impression I have of the ones that I have read is that, well, first of all, obviously your family is very important to you,
mm-hmm.
but they seem to be also what you most write about.
I guess maybe a fourth or a little bit more of my poems end up being about family. I have a lot of love poems.
Mm-hmm. Some wonderful love
some
poems.
Other ones, yeah.
One that's fairly recent, that's not a love poem, at least I wouldn't describe it that way, is called Courage for a New Year.
Oh, yeah.
And I love the two lines, in these early hours, starting over, seems possible.
Mm. Would you like me to read that one?
Yes, I would. I like to think that way at the beginning of a new year.
And I did. I wrote it on New Year's Eve last year, not this past, but the previous year, because I have a habit of, you know, my husband always plays gigs on New Year's Eve.
Oh, right. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
And I love to write in the new year. So get that replenishing alone time by just thinking over the whole year and naming everything I can think of that I'm thankful for, and then moving into goals if I get there. But often I don't get there because I have so many things to be thankful for. So it's a great way to start the year. But this is called Courage for a New Year. It was published in the online journal Sheila Nagig this past year. Courage for a New Year. All familiar things are released of connotation. In these early hours, starting over seems possible. A shoe on the step becomes hopeful, loses its dereliction, was going somewhere all along. Paper clutter on a bedroom shelf vibrates with history. Old photos, proof of a hard-won past, forecast an unexpected, cheery present. The blank page is a blizzard, and on dog sled we course our way through blinding brightness. While the year is young, it seems possible to arrive. We cannot lose our way before we find it.
Mm. That's a really cool line. I really like that. And it's so true, isn't it? And
yeah, mm-hmm.
In the spirit of that, our Madhya mm-hmm. is entering the new year with all kinds of plans for a new start and a new project.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, having been in the yoga world, you know, out and about for 2 decades now,
mm-hmm.
that, yeah, I've purchased a home, like a commercial home for yoga. So it feels
awesome.
It feels more intimate and more where there's a place for the introverts and the extroverts.
Yeah, okay.
But a safe, like a space that feels really where the vulnerability can happen.
Mm-hmm.
And so starting that this year, moving into that realm and in the teacher training. So like moving into offering more and more of educating people to become, step into the teacher role.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's awesome.
To be honest, it didn't occur to me when I invited both of you to come in together how much you have in common just in what you do every day.
Mm-hmm.
Everything that you say, I would think, resonates with Rachel. Mm-hmm. The notion of finding a safe space for people, that's what you were talking about, really,
yeah,
wasn't it?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That you somehow have to make your classroom, even though you, unlike Madhya, you know, you don't have control of that space. It's somebody else's space
mm-hmm.
that you enter.
Right.
And probably a different room every year
yeah.
that you have to then figure out how you're going to make the space work for
right.
you.
Right, that's true.
Why do you want to be a teacher?
Because I'm a learner. So it's definitely the love of learning and the love of process and the need to articulate process that is pretty important to the teaching process. So that part of it felt natural. And, of course, there's more freedom in that in college than there is in high school, where there are state standards and pacing guides and things like that. But I think that, you know, no learning can happen without respect. So that safe space is super important, especially because there's so many people who are traumatized these days. So many students that, at least at the school where I am, that come from trauma and are in the middle of trauma and can barely wrap their brains around learning because of it for various reasons. And so it's like, well, really, you know, they kind of have to be the subject. And I am able to do that since I'm a co-teacher in a classroom, except for some small classes that I also teach. So I can individualize
Is one of the reasons for the trauma financial challenges?
There's the county I teach in is a county of poverty, and so there's a lot of attendant social issues with that. The same as urban issues, but more rural, some urban. And so, yeah, you know, as I'm a Christian, and so the grace that I've received, I give. And, you know, I hear students say, and it makes me cringe, like, if you want respect, you gotta give respect. I'm not going to respect anybody who doesn't respect me. Well, that's so twisted. It's like we each have dignity and worth because God made us. And, you know, who I am is what I'm going to be to somebody. I'm not going to wait and see how they're going to be to me before I act this way to them. But that's just kind of
That's a defense mechanism, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
The reason I brought that up is because you wrote a poem called The Poor.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I didn't even bring that one, but I'll read it. Yeah. I wrote
because I thought it's a beautiful poem, the way it's expressed.
Yeah. My sort of extended family is New City Fellowship Church, which I've been involved with since I was in college. And it's started out as a ministry to the poor in the Black community in Chattanooga. And I wrote this back then, The Poor. In the sky, it's raining backwards, always backwards. From where we stand, it is a nightmare. Our tears are the sprinkler system of heaven. The clouds grow lush and green. They tantalize beyond our ability to desire. We stand poor with sand in our shoes and dust in our mouths, holding buckets upside down to catch the rain.
So part of what that poem seems to be saying is that everything's stacked against them.
Right, just that total helplessness and hopelessness.
Something that I'm not sure many of us really understand.
Right. It's just
unless,
like, well,
unless
just
you've
do
truly
this.
Been,
just
you know, in that,
that
place.
Yeah. It's poverty of imagination and resources.
Okay. Wow. Okay. So, well, I'm just listening to, you know, again, the language and the depth. And when you mentioned earlier about, you know, when you're working and you're teaching and your classes and how you want to be there for your students in a way where you see them, you know, for who they are and teach from that position. It's all connecting to your poetry to me. It's like who you are is coming through, you know, in all parts. Like the poetry and who you are not separate.
Yeah, when I was feeling frustrated with my vocation, I got some really good counsel, and that was to think of myself as a poet who happens to teach instead of a teacher who happens to be a poet, because that's not my modus operandi. Mm-hmm. I feel kind of mm-hmm. marginalized in a way mm-hmm. because I just think differently.
Yes. Yeah.
So it's like, oh, well, that's a good way for me to think of it. And so that's,
yeah, but that's yeah. how it, that's how yeah. it is very, to me, very yogic in the sense of,
okay.
There's a thread, an integration, not a separation.
Yes.
And so who you are is who you are.
Yeah.
Wherever you go, there you are.
There, yes.
And that's what I'm picking up as I sense into what you, your poetry, by the way, I mean, is really beautiful. And I do see, you know, just a talent in there. It's very, very good.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, very good. But I think it's, we were talking earlier about how, you know, teaching yoga, when I'm in the role of teaching, mm-hmm. that there is, and thank you for the recognition, that the connection here, that there is a poetry to teaching the way I teach it, particularly because there's, I like to create a lot of space. And I was talking about this pregnant pause and how that's, it's almost where it's underneath the words or in the spaces or in the rhythm of the words mm-hmm. that something gets revealed and that mm-hmm. we don't have to spell it out as the teacher or as the poet.
Exactly. Yeah.
It's a matter of like
her facilitator.
Right. Kind of like, yeah. Right. So it's really beautiful. And how you mentioned, you know, the, it's like my, you know, the, my philosopher, you know, people call me a yoga teacher or yogi in that sense, but there's at my core, you know, I really am a philosopher. And
oh yeah, I think
right.
you are.
Right.
And so, as long as I've known you, that's the impression mm-hmm. I have of you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I don't claim it outwardly.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's kind of.
Sure. But that's where you come. That's the space you're coming at everything from. Like
yes.
you're telling me that. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, awesome. Wow. And mm-hmm. this feeds my soul, like feeds me so deeply. We were talking about this, too, about it being kind of an admitted introvert. Even though there's extroverted abilities, mm-hmm. that where I get nourished is mm-hmm. this type of connection and conversation, and that in our culture we were also mentioning how it's even tougher these days to find that space and place because we're going faster and faster.
Yes,
and I find myself not kind of feeling a little disjointed, like when I'm with others. Sometimes I'm like,
yeah, yeah.
Because they're moving, and then I'm here, and they're looking at
it's
me.
It's been
as
lovely, but I really have to scream now.
I need some space.
Yeah,
and yeah, yeah. I get very overstimulated, and
uh-huh.
sometimes I even exit a scenario quite abruptly. And I'm sure some people are like, "What just happened?"
Oh yeah,
because I just went
right. Yeah,
I try to be polite, but sometimes I'm just like, "Gotta go. I can't."
Yeah,
right. It's just too much.
Yeah.
So to find the people and the places where we can feel safe and in the sense of, because I work with a lot of like experiences and trauma too in some of the other work that I do. And so there really is, you know, I think, again, too much or lack of acknowledgement for sensitivity for those of us that feel a level of sensitivity and depth and find space for that. And poetry is such a eloquent way to access people,
isn't it? Just this is a love poem. This appears to be addressed to a partner, and at one point it's called "Hold the Moon," and the it's divided by Roman numerals 1 through 5 and 1 through 4 rather, and this is Roman numeral 2. "You are a house without doors. I am a house without walls. It's raining. Open the window and let me in."
Yeah.
But I love that idea of "you are a house without doors. I'm a house without walls." It's as it was with that student you were just talking about. You know, I'm not going to respect somebody who doesn't respect me.
Oh, yeah.
So that's a person, a house without doors.
There's
no way into that person because they've got these.
That's true. Yeah.
The shell all around them.
Yeah. Yeah. And this poem, "Hold the Moon," is a love poem, really, to my husband. And you know how opposites attract. And
yeah,
we do need certain things from each other. And I, especially at the beginning of our marriage, didn't have boundaries very, very healthy boundaries. And he was like a walled city. So, yeah. Do you want me to read this?
Please do. I love this poem. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. All right. It's called Hold the Moon, and it was in the Stickmin Review a few years ago. You can find it online. Hold the Moon. One. Wading through the cold current of your silence, I am waist deep, going deeper as I move towards you. Your skin of night is soft and hot, almost against me, but an ice flow breaks loose, pushes me away. For a moment, I forget to breathe, the cold air dangerous, jagged in my chest. What a pair we are. You fear intimacy, I fear abandonment. Love, think of the continents our blood has traveled to bring us here. Two, you are a house without doors. I am a house without walls. It is raining. Open the window and let me in. Three, does my unrequited love for words render you silent? Or does your silence render my love for words unrequited? All I know is when the words come in my torrent of loneliness, you are left looking silly, helpless as any man, desperately clutching an umbrella under a volcano. Four. 6 years ago, I lifted our daughter high under a December night sky, until her small heart filled up with words of longing. Oh, hold you, moon. Wordless lexicons opened up inside me, and I felt held in that moment. Is this your language, and will you teach me? Never mind, love, don't speak. Just hold me like that.
That's beautiful.
That's what it comes down to in the end, isn't it? And I'm not sure that it isn't the same for you, Mardia, when you're teaching. Just hold me like that.
Yeah.
So you don't have to tell me anything.
Yes.
Just bring me into this safe space and help me find my place.
Yeah, find who you are, listen to you, hear you. And that somatic piece, you know, just hold me like that. Even though this, you know, this symbolism, you can be held, you know, mentally, emotionally, but embodying that too, the actual physical hold, the hold. And yoga is all those, the practice is those dimensions, and as a teacher, so I can feel into that really, really well. I'm going to read some of these, if you don't mind, in my next classes.
Oh, I'd be flattered.
Yes,
thank you.
I'm definitely going to do that. Because it really is the body language, you know, there's the tie-in of the body language.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
We're whole beings. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And sort of saying the unsaid or the previously things I didn't give myself permission to say, and I can say them in poetry. And I think some of that comes from having grown up in a dysfunctional family. My mother was schizophrenic. And it was a loving family, but we didn't talk about her illness. And I found myself as a young adult being attracted to poets who were from countries with repressive governments, and they had to use rich symbolism because they couldn't come out with other words. And it's like, yeah, that's what I had to do when I was coming up too. And writing was a safe space to speak.
Yeah.
And was a way to say the things that I wasn't allowed to just say out loud, not because anybody was objectively saying don't, but, you know, the don't talk rules and stuff in dysfunctional families. So.
It's amazing how the wounds that happen to us, the wounding that draws out this kind of magical uniqueness that each of us has. And if the wound, you know, is honored in the sense of like allowing yourself to even grieve, but to take that and turn that into something like acknowledge later, like you're doing even now, it's like, wow, that developed something in you Yeah, you know, that absolutely. That has turned, you know, turned into something so amazing. You know, that's what I hope to hold for people too, is that idea that, you know, you're not broken. You're not broken. You're actually pieces and parts that just aren't connecting. Like, it's like the idea.
Keep talking.
Yeah, so it's like that, because when we think, it's all about that neurolinguistics, you know, when we say things to ourselves or out loud and how we formulate that. So when you start to move away from the idea that you're broken, that you start to know that there were like a puzzle or a tapestry or some beautiful piece of art that just needs to be, you know, the canvas just needs a little more, like, can we put those together so that we can make this whole? And through the radical acceptance, you know, of our backgrounds, you know, of what's happened. And that, again, means feeling it, though, too.
Right. Like, and that's a scary place to be. It. I think sometimes when I get really busy, it's like, what am I running from? I don't want to stop and feel certain things. And whether it be to reprocess old grief or to deal with what happened yesterday that I don't want to think about or whatever. But, yeah.
And there's something about the storage of that, because emotions are energy. So it's almost like if we don't. There's not some outlet, then my experience is that it gets tucked.
I'm telling you.
And so you get the tension, and then sometimes the tension can turn into something more than just tension.
Yeah.
If we don't have an expression. And,
and
I realize that if we have a shared safe space, that sometimes the language helps, or the held space with someone that you feel safe and can trust. But in yoga, sometimes we can get into a pose that expresses a shape, and we can find the revelation of like, whoa, that was tucked in, and we don't know like where
okay.
it came from.
Yeah.
Kind of, whoa. And then you breathe and you use the breath, that breath, to kind of soften and shift our physiology. And we can get into like a parasympathetic space that allows us to deepen and open. And there's a new thing I do where we're kind of like, we're in these deep holds in a chair, like a physical hot, you know, you're sitting like you're in a chair, so your body's starting to work hard.
Yeah.
You're sitting down. And then we reach up and we inhale, and then we just, ha! You know, you just say it like really loud, just, ha! And just without saying what your ha is, people have reported that there is an enormous shift, because it can be anger or grief, something you just needed to. So there's something really amazing that happens with that, without spelling it out.
It
is relief.
Well, maybe you can't spell it out.
You can't. That's out. Only, just like we're talking about needing the process to access certain feelings and probably memories too, right?
Yes.
Like the memories come then too, I would think.
And a lot of times we don't, and a lot of times it's not that. It's the lack of understanding it. We don't have to necessarily always understand, even
right.
though we want to.
Right.
This brain can so hang us up.
Right.
But if you can just feel it, express it, and release on some level.
Yeah.
Yeah. Beyond the understanding.
Yeah.
Be helpful.
Yeah. I have a poem that kind of shows some of that. It's the Grief Reunion. I don't think you have that one.
Okay.
So I'm sorry that I didn't think to bring copies, but it's called Grief Reunion, and it's a bit longer. It's about a page and a half, but it's in parts also, Roman numeral parts. Grief Reunion, 1, Ishinomaki Community Center, Japan. That was where the tsunami hit the worst. In the tatami room, the mourners' faces are fixed, smiling masks. Their eyes are not smiling. The tsunami of sorrow has taken whole villages out to sea. It spewed back rubble and a few broken bodies. And now we are here, together with each of our losses, packed inside like Russian dolls, our layered grief. 2, stillness. Blue-white winter morning, one day past Christmas. Fog lifts from the valley. Pale blue sky slowly grows deeper than eyes. 3, root chakra. Wedge of glass in the foot, sudden shock of blood. Root of bitterness in the heart, rising taste of death. If I feel the earth firmly beneath me on this mat, I may weep for brokenness or joy that I am held up, that I will not collapse under the weight of sorrow. The yoga instructor says, see yourself arriving here. Why? I came but took no notice, mind going in many directions. Oh, when my father died, I was miles away. Because I did not arrive, I cannot leave. Later, my voice carries across an ocean to translate this epiphany for my daughter. When I die, be with me if you can. Hold me so you can let me go. The earth will not hold me up forever. 4. Fear has many names, and my body knows them all. The heart pounding for no reason at midnight in the quiet of the house, rehearsing for catastrophe, the tightening in the hips, hamstrings, and knees that makes my footfall heavy on the stairs, the clamping neck and shoulder pain that closes my heart, shortens my breath, the churning stomach at the sumptuous feast. If anger is a closed fist, sorrow is a limp hand. I want to dance in the driving rain, arms overhead, holding nothing. Sing while the water whips sideways or flows down my face into my open mouth. I want Jesus to walk across this stormy sea. Command me out of the peril of the boat into the strange safety of the waves. If only I don't look down. If only I don't look down.
Hmm. Well, that one definitely matches up there.
Rachel Landrum Crumble is our guest. She just read her poem along with Madia Swycord, who is with Madia's Healing Arts. Actually, two things went through my mind listening to that. One, it seems like everything starts with words or finding the words.
Yeah.
Whether it be what you do, Madia, or what you do, Rachel.
Mm.
But the other thing that you definitely have in common is that you both have children.
Mm.
It's almost impossible to read the newspaper anymore. It's so depressing,
yeah.
You know,
mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering how that feels to you as parents, mm-hmm. because so much of what is in the newspaper is a harbinger of things to come in the next 2 or 3 decades.
Right, mm-hmm. It's true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, with my child, I really do. He's a teenager, and I just basically, not just with him, but with my closest others, we talk a lot about how. You know, you have to, it's about how we affect the world is by how we move in the world. And so we have to be aware of what's happening, but we can't allow that to crush us. We can we have to do what we can do.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the gifts that we can offer, you know, and I say this to him even as a teenager, he's an only child. So I've been talking to him in a way that's probably advanced for ever since he was born. But anyway.
Yeah, get it.
I said, yeah, I say, you know, you have to, I tell him, be kind and be courageous. You know, be kind and be courageous because you have to create your own peace.
Mm.
You have to create your own peace and offer that to others. It's kind of like, don't wait for someone to, respect you.
Right.
And you reverberate out.
Mm-hmm.
But it is tough to read. I find myself in this dance, you know, to know what's happening.
Yeah.
You know, to know that there's a lot of big things happening that are overwhelming. And how do you hold your child, you know, in the midst of that?
Yeah. That another layer for that for me was being raising biracial children. My husband's black in the 80s and 90s here in Chattanooga in the South. And my husband and I are transplanted Yankees. We've lived here longer than anywhere, so it's home to us. But at the same time, we're always aware that we're outsiders. But in a way, I'm really thankful that we raised them here, because what I said to them when they were younger is that, like, evil has a real face. Like, it's not an institution here. It's like somebody calling you the N-word. Mm-hmm. And it's like, oh, yeah, there it is. Mm-hmm. But it tends to be more institutionalized in the North and other places in the country where it's like you can't quite touch us, but it's like, oh, I know that. That's ugly. Okay, I can deal with the ugly because I can speak back to it and I can remember who I am. And so sort of coming from a place of with our children, and we had this conversation a lot from the time they were really little on up, was you are first ours. Well, first God created you, so you're precious and valuable. Mm-hmm. Then you're ours, mm-hmm. so you're precious and valuable. Mm-hmm. Then you're each one of us, so you're part of me. So you have, and of course, race is a construct. So, but, you know, you can be proud of who you are with me, that you're, you know, you're biracial, you're black and you're white, and different friends of mine even have raised their kids differently with this. But I said, but the culture will look at you and say you're black, and you should embrace that because that's precious. Mm-hmm. And, you know, talking with them a lot about Black history and helping them to embrace that part of who they are, so that they're not like, oh, I'm not that. Yeah, you are, but, and people think only in those binary terms. Not so much today. I think people understand a little bit more about multiracial.
You're around teenagers a lot. And that's my impression too, that this generation seems to be more open-minded than any generation I've seen previously.
I feel like that what's happened is that they've forgotten history, which is even scarier, because I see that they don't know the stories, that they're not, even though they're maybe a generation removed from the stories about how hard won their, you know, certain freedoms are, that they don't know the stories, and so they don't appreciate maybe even their own backgrounds. Mm-hmm. African-American students, I teach some of them, or mm-hmm. or what it takes, you know, that why as a white kid shouldn't you use the N-word with a friend just because it's on a rap song? Mm-hmm. Like, just because if they call each other that, they've won the right to do that. That's for them. It's not for you. And, you know, they don't understand appropriation or any of that. So
what? I find it interesting, yeah. Rachel, that, you know, I'm from Gainesville, Florida.
Okay.
So I moved here, transplant, while I was in my 20s.
Mm.
And Florida is much more culturally, it's just a more diverse, at least where I'm from a university town.
Okay.
I mean, University of Florida.
Okay.
And there was a lot of diversity, and not that racism wasn't, it was very still, obviously still there.
Mm.
But it was a real dramatic shift when I moved here. Like, when I moved here, I was really, and you want to talk about the N-word, like, I was raised with, never appropriate.
Right.
Just a respectful thing to not. And I was really sideways with how I heard it, and I would just pass out, almost could not believe that this area, it was just,
yeah,
I felt like I was moving from Germany, you know, like, or from Italy to Germany.
Okay.
That's how I felt when I moved from Florida.
Yep. How about
for
that?
For many reasons.
Yeah.
That was a standout.
Mm.
And I've even had friends that grew up in this area that I can, sometimes I'll be with them and there'll be this kind of undertone, like they'll say, I'm good with it. I'm good with, and then they'll say something.
I'll
say, did you just notice what you said underneath that? Because that sounded racist.
Yeah.
And it's so insidious.
Yes.
I'm just pick up on it from my experiences. So I imagine moving at that time here, challenging.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Right?
You've written about this a lot, Rachel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Would you mm-hmm. care to read one of your poems?
Oh.
Sure. Black Friday is one that I'll go ahead and read that. It was in an anthology called Carrying the Branch, Poets in Search of Peace in 2017. And Emily Dickinson was a poet who in high school I found, and it was like, oh my gosh, mm-hmm. like, she she's my my sister from another era. She had the language. She found the language for things. And there's a poem called "There's a Certain Slant of Light, Winter Afternoons," that carries like the heft of cathedral tunes, heavenly hurt. It brings us, we can find no scars, but internal difference where the meanings are. None may teach it any. Is the seal despair, imperial affliction sent us from the air. None may, I can't remember the rest of it, all of it. But anyway, I'm taking, like, I have these Roman numeral parts that just take up a portion of some different lines from that poem. It's called Black Friday. One, there's a certain slant of light. Late afternoon squints through the west windows. I am content with leftovers and quiet. My male child accounted for and sleeping safely home. Two, heavenly hurt it gives us. A distant dog barks without conviction. Traffic swooshes steadily two blocks away. The last of the gold and scarlet leaves tumble from the trees. Protesters in Chicago carry this message down the magnificent mile. Justice is the public face of love. 16 shots and Laquan McDonald's 17-year-old life folded like a knife. Three, none may teach it any. A ladybug crawls across the screen, unfolds wings, flies off. My synapses still smarting from the 2 a.m. phone call, felony charge, detention hearing. 2 weeks ago, I told my son, be careful who you get in a car with. It could cost you your very life. Four, when it comes, the landscape listens. Today, in Chicago, Paris, and Chattanooga, shadows held their breath, mourning, senseless violence. Seven shootings in 3 days in my city alone. The youngest to die in the Paris attacks was 17. My son is just that age today. I exhale. There are reasons why the heart is convalescent.
Many reasons, if you were to read your other poetry, and it's not as if it comes as news to any of us.
Right.
That the zeitgeist at the moment seems to be so fractured.
Yes.
And fraught.
Yeah.
You know.
It's true.
And you talked about race being a construct. Gender is equally a construct.
Okay.
And you both are wrestling with that one all the time. And that also seems to be something that's being challenged. A lot of the assumptions that we had about gender and how you treat people.
Yeah.
You know, for you, Rachel, it's a double whammy. You, on top of which you have a daughter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
One of her parents is black.
Yeah. Yeah. And she lives in California, and she says that race rarely comes up because what the brown people treat them like their own, whoever they are, and they own her, and she looks like she could be this or she could be that, and she kind of, you know, but she embraces who she is. As a, you know, when she was at GPS, she helped start a club, a sort of a unity club kind of thing.
Forgive me if this is too personal, but work is personal.
Yeah.
When you met Jim, and you both decided to marry, neither one of you are naive. You understood, especially in the 1980s.
Right. We,
what that
in fact,
meant.
We were, when we were just kind of like buddies hanging out, we went to Cloudland Canyon. I guess we were a little more than buddies, but we weren't like, we wouldn't have considered that we were dating. We went to Cloudland Canyon and we got run out. Two white guys came up, young white guys, and they wouldn't even look at Jim or address him, which I found so weird. They just looked at me and said, mind if I ask you something? And I said, what? And they said, ask you to leave. And I'm like, why? We're at a state park. In fact, we're sitting there with the Bible open on the picnic table. And I'm like, dude, you know, we're not hurting anybody. And I said, why? And he said, because you're here with a black man and he's here with a white woman. And if you were here with a white man and he was here with a black woman, that would be okay. But we don't allow this kind of stuff on our mountain. And two men just went to get shotguns, and you better leave and take the same roads you came by. So we left because there were no rangers or anything around. And I was so upset. And it was funny when I compared notes with my husband later, when he was my husband. Mm-hmm. He said he was angry that he was even dating or sort of talking to a white woman again, because he said he would never do that again. So his was like, why am I putting myself in this space again? And me, I was just feeling what that's like for the first time, you know, to feel threatened.
I'm assuming that wasn't the first time that somebody had made some kind of overtures to him like that.
Well,
but was it the first time that he'd had a relationship with a white person?
No, in fact, when he was in college, we would just hang out. I was a student here at UTC, in fact, when we started hanging out. And I was used to hanging out with guys as friends, so it was not a big deal, except that he kept calling me. So I was like, what is this? But we were at Yellow Deli, which is back in town and used to be a long time ago. And he said to me when we were there, what would your father do if he walked in right now? And I said, he'd be fine. He dated a black woman in the 70s after my parents divorced. They lived in Columbia, Maryland, which is fairly progressive. But even then, they caught hell for that. So I said, he'd be fine. I said, what about yours? And he said, he is deathly afraid I'm going to marry a white woman because my two best friends did. But I'm never dating a white woman again because when I did in college, her parents threatened to pull her out of school if she didn't break up with me. And I really wasn't offended because at that point I wasn't romantically attracted to him. I was like, oh, okay. No. So
in other words, at that point,
yeah,
he was saying, you know, there's a line and I'm not going to cross it. We can be friends,
right?
But I don't want to get any more involved.
And I was fine with that. But then he kept asking. Then one time he was stuttering about asking me out, and I'm like, oh, you're really asking me on a date? And he was like, I need to talk to you. I've been praying about this. And I'm like, ooh. And
what about you? What was your feeling about it?
I tend to kind of process when things are in front of my face in terms of that sort of thing. And I wasn't like attracted to him, but it didn't bother me at all to like hang out with him. And I didn't think there was anything wrong with dating interracially either. But when he said, would you be willing to pursue a dating relationship with me? And he had prayed about it for days and wrestled with it. And me knowing what the cost of that had been for him in the past, I trusted him, and I trusted his walk with God enough to go, okay. And then the feelings came. Yeah. That's kind of how it went. Yeah. But I have another love poem about that, sort of summing up that love relationship. It's called In Praise of Detours, and this was published in the Porterhouse Review last year. In Praise of Detours. At the starting line of my white suburban guilt, I first foresaw a tweedy, liberal blue blood in my future, a family friend, then, God forbid, a disheveled manic angel. I was on my way to an addiction to unstable men who would disappoint me, fair-haired, blue-eyed progeny, a divorce. But traffic was heavy. I was impatient and took a detour. You were on your way to winning a black trophy wife to please your father, who always disappointed you. You were this quirky drummer with a blowout fro and a laugh and a stutter. You never wanted to date a white woman again, and I didn't care. I thought you were sent on some mission of rescue, by a mutual friend. Not sure what you saw, but you couldn't leave me alone. You called me from the phone in my dorm lobby and took your time asking me out. 35 years later, our three children have your heart-shaped face and my smile, conceived in the laughter we share. Tonight, I arrive here knowing I have loved you more than half my life, and that more than this house, you are my home.
When we were talking earlier about romantic relationships, we have this abiding fantasy as a culture about what romantic relationships mean. And I imagine it's true for you. It's certainly true for me that the longer I live, the more I realize how complicated any kind of relationship is.
Yeah, I recommend therapy. We went through therapy, for sure. And it was just because of family of origin issues, you know.
But you wrote a poem. It's called After the 2016 Election.
Oh, yeah.
And it talks about your fears for your son.
Yeah.
The fears that I have heard so many black parents express.
Right.
That they're out there by themselves. They're teenagers.
Yes.
And it doesn't make, like any teenager, it doesn't make any difference how many times you tell them this will probably happen.
Yeah.
And this is how you need to behave if it does.
Right.
It's scary. It seems to me that, so we're on the same page about relationships and how complicated they are anyway.
Right.
And yours is exponentially that much more complicated because you have... In effect, you have two constructs that you're wrestling with.
Yeah.
Race and gender,
For
most of us, one is enough,
Yeah. I think we did a better job, of processing that with our two older kids than with the younger one. I think because times kind of changed, too.
Really? Because I had the impression that you felt the times weren't exactly convivial when you first...
Right.
Started your relationship.
Right. No, they weren't.
but in the arc of your life together, it went from bad to better to
better.
Bad again. Is that what you're saying?
Well, yeah. I mean, I didn't say that, but I agree with you about that. It's true. Mm. And yes, yeah. Yeah, that whole fallacy when Obama was president that we were in a post-racial era, I absolutely did not believe that bull when it started, people started saying that. However, I think a lot of teenagers think that they can somehow relate to a naked personality without their race and that there's something enlightened about that. And there's nothing enlightened about that because God created ethnicity, not the construct of race, but ethnicity and culture, and so we don't even really understand each other if we don't dignify each other by acknowledging that history. Mm. The history. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right.
Right. So, yeah. Did you want me to read that poem, or we probably don't have time, do we?
I'll be happy for you to read it.
Okay. So, after the 2016 election, and My apologies to my conservative friends, but I'm speaking from an experience here. After the 2016 election, we share this common irritant, the smoke of distant fires. It scalded the morning and evening sun, ember red, then hung a net of haze over the city. After 2 days, friends are confined indoors, wheezing. My throat is raw. Sinuses ache. Now dark clouds rise from the mountain. The day after the election, police in Alton Park stop black residents up and down the boulevard as if it is apartheid or a new Jim Crow. My son is driving, stopped in traffic, radio blaring. A cop on a motorcycle passes, hangs a U, comes back. Tickets him for going 50 in a 35-mile zone. Yes, sir, is the drill we instilled when we had the talk all parents have with their sons of color. 5 miles over the state line in Georgia, a white boy walks the high school parking lot, a Confederate flag tied at his neck like a cape. Later, black students yank it from his backpack, stomp on it, igniting threats of a race war. My eyes are burning. Smoke threads through the indoor air in the gym and large commons. We choke on the fire of distant words. Not again.
Our guest, Rachel Landrum Crumble, is a poet, but she's also a teacher, and a high school teacher at that. And I'm wondering how you help these kids cope with this stuff.
Oh, boy. Yeah. And that's, I mean, you know, we're there in an occasion to deal with the subject. And so I'm not trying to be everything to those kids. They need me to be the best teacher in whatever the subject area it is. But as it comes up, boy, I can't touch a lot of that stuff just because we don't have time to when I'm with students. But I'm alarmed when I see even students in high school in, like, interracial dating relationships having total ignorance about what the import of that has been historically, and yet them acting out in very stereotypical ways that, you know, that grandmother that they're one generation removed from would have smacked some sense into them and told them their history. I'm not talking about the history of you stay in your place. I'm talking about you have dignity and worth. Treat yourself like you have dignity and worth. Don't experiment with something that's different just because it's different. That's objectifying something that's really not, you know, like skin color is exotic or something. It's like, that's, come on, get underneath that, you know. I mean, I've had students say to me when they found out that I was married to a black man, oh, did you always date black men? It's like, no, it's not like a flavor of ice cream that I chose. I loved this man. Like, I saw the individual man, but it's also not like other people who say, oh, I don't see race. I only see people. And I'm like, how do you see them? How can you possibly see that person if you don't see all of who they are? So it's kind of like it's neither one. It's like, no, this man is an amazing man, and I embrace his cultural heritage and want to honor it. In fact, tried to break up with him because I felt like he should marry a black woman who would understand him better. That didn't last very long because we were both very unhappy. But anyway, yeah.
All I can say is your students are lucky to have you, aren't you?
Well, thank you.
And it's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it.
Thank you so much for sharing your poetry. You have a particular set of challenges, but you seem to be handling really well.
Well, there is a God in heaven, and he's in me. So there you go.